Are there any useful obesity interventions that can be used in primary care?
And is aspirin helpful in the healthy elderly patients?
What's the impact of pollution and traffic volume on the development of dementia?
And e-cigarettes using marijuana in middle and high school students.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on September 21st, 2018.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine. And welcome back to the U.S., Elizabeth, after a successful bicycling trip in Spain.
Well, thank you very much, and I really had a wonderful time. Hope to go back again, actually. I'm going to drag you along next time, get you away from France. Let us turn to the studies. Let's turn right to the Journal of the American Medical Association. This was updated guidelines from the USPSTF on obesity interventions that can be used in primary care settings and whether they're really worth anything. The last time these folks took a look at this was in 2012, and they start this review with the rather daunting statistic that 35% of American males and 40% of American females are considered obese. In reviewing the evidence of what is available in a primary care setting, so no bariatric surgery considered in this particular document, they found that there was a moderate benefit to intensive multi-component behavioral interventions with folks who are overweight, with a significant improvement in weight status, and also a reduced incidence of type 2 diabetes, which of course is a really big concern in people who are obese. They also found moderate benefit was seen with behavioral-based weight loss maintenance interventions, and they found no harms associated with any of these treatments. Ultimately, they gave a B recommendation to referring patients with a BMI greater than 30 to behavioral intervention to help manage their obesity.
If you follow someone over a course of, in these studies, 12 to 18 months, people were more successful in losing weight. They lost an average of about 6 or 7 more pounds than individuals that didn't have behavioral intensive work, and they were more likely to keep the weight off as well. Now, the secondary studies they report on are the pharmacotherapies. There are some individuals that, despite intensive behavioral therapy, really can't lose weight or don't lose a sufficient amount. Pharmacotherapy can be helpful, but in this particular case, there is harm associated with that because there are some adverse effects. So the initial therapy shouldn't be pharmacotherapy, it should be intensive behavioral therapy.
One of the things that I find a little bit objectionable here is the idea that one needs to wait until someone's BMI is greater than 30 to refer them to any kind of intervention. I find that to be not a great strategy.
The reason why the USPSTF addressed a BMI over 30, because that's where the studies center. Elizabeth, I agree with you. You want to prevent obesity, but unfortunately, once it develops, intensive behavioral therapy, and there are a lot of different ways to deliver it, can be helpful in both losing weight and maintaining that weight loss.
Right. I think that every time someone interacts with the healthcare system, there ought to be some assessment of whether they're trending in that direction.
Absolutely.
Speaking of prevention, then, let's turn to yours. We're going to consider these three studies together, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, relative to aspirin. It's prevention capabilities, and also its harms.
This is the first time we've combined three studies into a single report. And it looked at a particularly interesting group. I may say it's interesting because I'm coming closer and closer and following into it. That's called the healthy elderly. Now, we know that aspirin is beneficial if somebody already has heart disease or has had a stroke. It's effective in preventing another event. That's secondary prevention. But in terms of primary prevention, if you have a healthy elderly individual and they're over the age of 70, should that individual be on aspirin or not? They looked at three different things. Does aspirin prevent cardiovascular events or cause bleeding? Does it affect what I'm going to call disability-free survival? And thirdly, what about all-cause mortality? So let's address those together. In this study of over 19,000 individuals who received a baby aspirin, followed for almost 5 years, aspirin did not prevent cardiovascular events. It did increase the risk of bleeding. It did not improve disability-free survival. And there was a slightly increased all-cause mortality, primarily related to cancer-related mortalities. And that was evident about 4 or 5 years into the study.
And so this, of course, runs counter to even another Australian study, which of course is where this one took place, that we reported a few years ago, where aspirin was useful in preventing melanoma in some of these people. We also saw, and have been hearing for many years, about aspirin's capacity in prophylaxis for colorectal cancer. So I'm a little conflicted here. I'm not sure what to believe.
Well, so you're right. This is the first time aspirin's been associated with an increased risk of cancer-related mortality. Most of the aspirin studies that showed cancer prevention were conducted in younger individuals where it can perhaps prevent colon polyps, and that prevents colorectal cancer. This suggests that in the older individuals, that's not the case. Now, there are no other studies yet that have shown this. I don't want people to think that aspirin increased mortality significantly. It was a small, about 1.5% overall increase. But it clearly shows that in the older individuals, it's not effective in preventing cancer. I think you can certainly draw those conclusions from this study.
Okay, so then let's return back then to cardiovascular risk, which clearly was one of the primary indications with regard to this study. What are you going to do right now with your healthy older folks when they say to you, what can I do to reduce my risk of a cardiovascular event?
I'm glad you brought that up. We know that maintaining a normal blood pressure, and that's incredibly important because about 80% of individuals age 80 or more have hypertension. Healthy lifestyle, healthy diet, maintaining a normal weight, all of those things improve cardiovascular health and decrease cardiovascular events.
Okay, that's the last word at least for today. Let's turn now to the BMJ Open. This is a look at something that I've been hearing about for many years, and that's the really negative health consequences of air pollution. And in this study, they also considered noise pollution. And they were looking at those two things with regard to the development of dementia. They studied over 130,000 adults aged 50 to 79 who were registered with general practices in the UK beginning in 2005. None of these folks had a previous history of dementia. They looked at particulate matter, ozone, and traffic intensity relative to postal codes where these folks lived, and they also assessed noise at night. Over the follow-up period, they had 2,181 people who were diagnosed with dementia. And they determined that there was about a 40% increased risk of dementia if they looked at the highest versus the lowest fifth of exposures to these particular traffic-related circumstances. They also attempted to look at all the known confounders, and they found out that this relationship still persisted.
And I thought this study was particularly innovative in showing that people's both proximity to traffic and measuring all the known pollutants, and they all were associated with an increased risk of dementia. They didn't assess what the underlying pathophysiology is, but we know that pollutants are associated with cardiovascular disease, inflammation as well, and both of those things have been associated with Alzheimer's disease.
Well, I think that this is yet one more piece of evidence relative to the negative health consequences of air pollution. That's one thing. And I at least applaud London for trying to reduce their traffic in and around the city. I think those are excellent public health strategies.
Absolutely, Elizabeth. As you said, no matter what population they looked at, whether you were a previous smoker or not, or whether you had other comorbidities, the increased exposure to pollutants increased your risk of Alzheimer's disease.
Very good. Now let's turn to our final one, in JAMA Pediatrics. Gosh, when kids are vaping, they might be vaping marijuana.
They examined the prevalence of cannabis use in electronic cigarettes among U.S. youths. The use of e-cigarettes has gone up substantially among our youth between the ages of 9 and 19. We're talking about middle and high schoolers, largely because advertising is directed toward that age group. Secondly, we know that cannabis use or marijuana use is becoming more prevalent across the United States. These over 20,000 students they surveyed are meant to be a representative sample of students that attend both public and private schools across the U.S. Nearly 1 in 11 U.S. students, including one-third of those who ever used e-cigarettes, had used cannabis in their e-cigarettes in 2016. Why is that important? The U.S. Surgeon General has concluded that e-cigarettes contain harmful and potentially harmful constituents. Secondly, we know that the National Academy of Sciences has found that cannabis use among youths adversely affects their learning, their memory, and it may impair their academic achievement and education. This is a warning sign to all our listeners and a warning sign to society in general that we need to reduce cannabis use in e-cigarettes, especially among our adolescents.
Well, I applaud the FDA for their action, their recent action, reining in that particular advertisement and attempt to get young people to use e-cigarettes. And I hope that they exercise some more of their power in order to curtail that activity.
You know, that's our most vulnerable population, not only in terms of health, but in terms of influence as well. And I think it's personally unconscionable to target that group. I applaud, as you do, the FDA for taking those strong stands.
On the blog this week, I'm going to consider the aspirin studies in the New England Journal of Medicine. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.